It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host Veronica Rickert is off today. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll have our weekly check-in on all things Congress. First, President Obama delivered his State of the Union speech last night, his sixth since taking office. While most of the speech focused on the improving economy and reforms and policies aimed at helping the middle class, he also touched on the country's foreign policy agenda and what he says we've accomplished overseas since he took office. But our next guest says the president doesn't have much to celebrate on the foreign affairs front, and his boasts about success beyond America's borders ring hollow as conflict continues across much of the Middle East and beyond. So where does the president go from here, and what needs to happen in his remaining 2 years in office? Joining us now is Frieda Gittes. She's a foreign affairs columnist for the Miami Herald and World Politics Review and a CNN.com opinion contributor. Frieda, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's good to be with you, Rob.
So President Obama laid out some of what he said were America's foreign policy successes, but you're mostly not buying it. Why not?
No, you know, I think the president looked comfortable and satisfied last night giving his speech, and he was, you know, he had reason to be happy. The opinion polls are looking good for him. The economy is doing well. But when he started talking about foreign policy, to me, it just rang hollow. There was something about it that just simply did not ring true. Things are not going well for him and for America and really for the world.
Well, let's key in on Syria, first of all. You say this is the greatest failure of the Obama administration, specifically the lack of sufficient action against Bashar al-Assad and his Syrian regime. Can you talk some more about that as a failure of American and President Obama's foreign policy?
You know, I've been writing about this for about 4 years. When the uprising against Assad began, it was a pro-democracy movement. The United States had the opportunity to help a pro-democracy movement, and what it did was stand back, take no action, and allow other players in the Middle East to intervene and take over the fight. And now the United States is left with no good choices. Syria has turned into an absolute worst-case scenario, and it is spreading far beyond its borders. What we're seeing, what we saw in Paris in the last few days, what we've seen in Ottawa and Canada and in Australia and throughout the Middle East now, in Iraq in particular, is the result of allowing the Syrian situation to deteriorate the way it has.
Was it ever really that simple in Syria, though? Obviously, it is incredibly complicated now, but was it as easy as just providing more, arms and military support to the early rebels against the Syrian regime? Or would that have sucked us into a more complicated situation than we wanted to be involved in?
It was never simple. The Middle East is a very complicated place, and Syria is a very complicated place. But I would argue that the way things have turned out is absolutely the worst-case scenario. I think a few years ago, the United States had some good choices. There was the possibility of strengthening the one group of players in that conflict that had an ideology that was consistent with international law, that was consistent with human rights, that was consistent with pluralism, with equality for women, with freedom of religion. And now there is no one to support, and we have these horrendous choices, and we have what we saw was that the horrific situation in Syria just burst through the borders of that country into Iraq. We have a humanitarian calamity of really horrendous proportions, and we have the spreading of this ideology. And I think the United States, a few years ago, was in a good position to help one side of this conflict, and now the choices are all really, really terrible.
Well, now, as you say, the Islamic State movement, so-called, has spread Syria into Iraq. The United States is involved in bombing campaigns against ISIS. Do you think we've made up, President Obama has made up some of the lost ground with the military action against ISIS?
Well, it's made up. I wouldn't say that it's made up a whole lot of ground. I think it has slowed the deterioration of the conflict. That's about as much as you can say about it. I mean, if you look today at Iraq, the government in Baghdad does not control the country. In Syria, there is no good player, basically. We have ISIS attacks now in Paris. And let's, you know, we're not even talking about the rest of the Middle East. Just even yesterday, just a few hours before the president took the podium in Congress, we had a coup in Yemen. You know, this is just, it's just the Middle East. Big parts of the Middle East are falling apart, and the fact of the matter is that the United States may not be as dependent on Middle Eastern oil as it once was, but the Middle East remains a very important part of the world. It's ideologically the focus of a very destructive ideology, and this is just not going away. Obama would, I'm sure he would have preferred to not have to talk about foreign policy, to not have to talk about the Middle East last night, but it's just not going away. It's important, and it'll be here. It'll continue to be a problem for the rest of the Obama administration.
Now, a lot of presidents have tried and failed on various issues in the Middle East, most specifically the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. How much of this is a failure of the Obama administration, and how much of it is just constant ongoing problems in a difficult region of the world?
There's no question it's a difficult region, but the United States is a very important player in the world. It's foreign policy, foreign affairs, history is not like a chemistry lab where you can try it one way and then try the exact same scenario with a different approach and see which one works better. But the United States is an important player, and when the United States steps back, you see bad results.
What would you like to see? As you say, there are no easy choices, difficult situations in Syria and the surrounding region. What would signal to you that President Obama is moving in the right direction in his last 2 years when it comes to the Middle Eastern region?
I'd like to see the United States take a much more aggressive role in developing partnerships with moderate forces. And granted, that is much more difficult now than it would have been several years ago. That there are some Syrians that are still looking for a more moderate course, but the United States is having to start from scratch. I think this needs to be done in a much more aggressive way. We keep hearing, and again, when I say aggressive, I mean financial, training. I'm not talking about sending American troops right now. I think ISIS has to be pushed back much more aggressively. I think the Kurds need to have very, very strong support from the United States, more than they've been receiving. And, that's the Middle East. We haven't talked about the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Forgive me for deviating from your question, but we didn't hear Obama talk at all about other parts of the world, like, for example, India, where he's going next week. A key player in the world and potentially a very important partner for the United States in the decades to come.
I did want to branch out, actually, from the Middle East to other parts of the world. He did address Russia there and American sanctions and sanctions from partners and the effect they've had on Russia. What did you make of what the president had to say when it came to Russia?
Well, it was uncomfortable. I found the whole piece on Russia a little bit awkward. First of all, he was bragging about the economic problems in Russia, which, in fairness, they were not the result of his actions, but the result of low oil prices. But even talking about it that way, he seemed to be taking joy in the suffering of the Russian economy, which is probably not the most constructive way to talk about the situation. Russia is still in control of Crimea, which is legally part of Ukraine. There's still people getting killed in eastern Ukraine who are supporters of Russia. The whole approach was he was taking credit for something that he did not deserve credit for, and it was something that should not have been painted in such a boastful way. The speech is mostly designed for domestic consumption in the United States, but it is heard and reviewed, and it has an impact around the world.
A lot of president watchers point to the second term as a time when presidents tend to turn to foreign policy. Just 2 years left now in that second term. Do you think President Obama can turn things around and leave a better world behind him than it is at this point?
It's going to be tough. Obama would. Other presidents have done that, and this case may just be the exception, because he is finally getting a turnaround in the economy, in large part because of the drop in oil prices. So he's probably going to prefer to focus on what's going on domestically, where he can take credit for improving economic conditions and still blame the Republicans for obstructing his plans to attack inequality. So I think he will be more comfortable on the domestic side unless he gets a breakthrough with Iran. I just don't see how he's going to leave a very positive legacy internationally, but we can always hope. If he leaves a positive legacy internationally, that will mean that something good has happened for the world and for America, so we should all hope that that's what happens.
Frida, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Frieda Gittes. She's foreign affairs columnist for the Miami Herald and World Politics Review and a CNN.com opinion contributor. President Obama made a strong pitch for liberal, Democratic-supported policies and values in that State of the Union speech last night. Many Democrats happy with the address, but they don't control the House or the Senate. Republicans have a large majority in Congress, which makes the president's agenda, well, hard to pass, to say the least. Also in Congress, Republicans are trying to block the president's immigration action through Department of Homeland Security funding. Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson has said he's okay with shutting down funding for the Department of Homeland Security if that's what it takes. It's our weekly look at Congress now with USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. Paul, good to have you back.
Nice to be back. Rob, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Well, you know, you're flying solo today, right? So tell me how I can help.
Well, you can help me by talking about this State of the Union thing. President Obama had his biggest crowd of Republicans since he took office out there. They've got big majorities. So what's he trying to do with this speech?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The line in the speech that caught my eye was, Obama said, "Well, I've run my last campaign. You know, I'm just here to advance the future of America," which, you know, is really not true. To some degree, what he was doing was laying out the Democrats' agenda for the next campaign. This speech was very much about rebuilding a Democratic ideology of boosting the middle class, taxing the rich, and investing in stuff like infrastructure, education, and poverty programs. I mean, that is, in some ways, a very real return to the progressive roots of the Democratic Party, which a lot of Democrats have complained they didn't really focus on in 2014 during the election season.
And there's been criticism, why didn't he focus on this stuff more when he had majorities in one or both houses? He's talking this talk now that there's really no support in Congress for passing the things he's talking about.
Right. Sort of an interesting conundrum, isn't it? I mean, if nothing else, it allows him to set up a pretty clear opposition with the Republican Party. Now that they control both the House and the Senate, Obama can say, and the Democrats can say, look, here's a bunch of good things we would do if the Republicans would let us. You could make the case that Obama didn't really have much opportunity to do this stuff in the previous Congress because there was a Republican House, so he'd never get anything voted on the floor anyway. And also, I mean, I think it's fair to say that part of his new initiative is based on really good economic numbers. I mean, the strong economy, the recently strong economy, gives him an excuse to say, okay, as he said, we have turned the page on sort of a strategy of managing decline. Let us now move again towards what he thinks is, lifting up the middle class and a strategy of an aggressive approach. Part of it is just the economic posture of the country makes it easier for him to do that.
Now, the president's been dropping spoilers for what he was going to say last night over the last week, really, and we were getting some sense of the Republican response even before the address happened. But
yes.
Since the actual speech, what are we hearing from leading Republicans?
Oh, a lot of what you'd expect. I mean, I think I was intrigued that Mitt Romney had a response on his Facebook page that kind of summed up what a bunch of Republicans have said, which is failure to lead, disappointing. Obama says he wants to compromise, but then he offers bills that are just the same old liberal stuff. That's been sort of the gist. The Republicans are all pretty much singing from the same hymnal. Of course, so are the Democrats. Democrats are saying he did a great job, and if only the Republicans would come to their senses and work with him, they can get something done. It's pretty much partisan politics as normal.
Now, one of our neighbors here from Wisconsin delivered the Republican response, Iowa Senator Joni Ernst. What did she focus on?
Well, you know, what's interesting about her is she didn't really talk about the policies so much. I mean, there was not an issue of we're going to do X and Y and Z. It was more, again, this issue of, trying to suggest that Obama needs to come to the table and negotiate with Republicans on things they can really work on. She particularly said that on tax loopholes and reducing the tax burden on Americans, the Republicans are ready to meet with Obama, and they think that they have some stuff he could agree on. But she also said, hey, look, the first thing we're going to do is push the Keystone XL bill. I was intrigued. She called it the Keystone XL jobs bill, did not mention the fact that it was a pipeline. So, again, it was fairly standard fair for the Republican response. I will say I thought Ernst did a perfectly fine job of delivering it. There was no whoops Twitter moments that blew up social media. So for a freshman senator, she did a nice job on her first major national announcement.
Some people have drawn attention to a difference between her English language response and the Spanish language response from Republican Florida Representative Carlos Curbelo. The Spanish language version talked, had a couple of paragraphs about immigration reform. English language one apparently did not. Is this a big deal in among Washington hipsters?
Oh, sure. I mean, it for those of us who like to cluck about things, it gives us something to cluck about, you know, and say, oh, look, they didn't do this. Sure, it's interesting that they mention immigration to a Spanish-speaking audience, but not to an English-speaking audience. Although, if you follow any politician around, you will note that the audience to whom they are speaking, the message changes a little bit. So I guess it's not all that surprising. But it was fun to watch Reince Priebus, the RNC chairman, on TV today trying to explain exactly what that all meant. And he shuffled and wagged a lot. I wouldn't make much of it, but that is how politics works.
So the president proposed some major policy issues. A fair amount of them Republicans said they're not going to touch. The president laid out some things he says he'll veto if Republicans send him to his desk. So in the next 2 years, are we going to see any room for common ground?
Well, you know, one of the early things out of the box you're likely to see that will develop some common ground is Obama says he's going to come to Congress seeking authorization for the use of military force in Iraq and Syria as part of our military campaign against the Islamic State militant group. That's going to get a lot of support. Interestingly enough, it'll get a lot of support amongst sort of conservative Democrats and a big chunk of the Republicans. He's going to lose a bunch of liberal Democrats who are concerned about, you know, once again, reopening a never-ending war in the Middle East. And it's possible that the Republicans are going to try to add some stuff he won't like. It's conceivable that they will try to push for more boots on the ground. But that is a topic where I think that Obama can actually see some real agreement amongst Republicans and Democrats. There's also these issues of the trade bills, particularly I think it's the Pacific Trade Agreement that Obama's trying to push now. I think you'll find a lot of support for that amongst the Republicans. So it's not like they have no common ground, but I think they will find that on the big issues, they are still very, very dramatically divided.
Not many times in the last, since we've been talking to you, Paul, you've said this legislation or this address or this speech was pitched toward the next election.
Yeah.
You mentioned that already, I think, for the State of the Union looking ahead at 2016. Is this just going to be another couple of years where it's a little bit of substance, a whole lot of showboating?
Yeah, but the interesting thing is going to be, obviously the presidential campaign of 2016 has already begun. We have Jeb Bush already making the noises about getting in. We have Webb from Virginia, former Senator Webb from Virginia, has already announced he's got an exploratory campaign. You know, I mean, people are getting into the water, so we're obviously in campaign mode. But there are things that Congress is going to have to do, like pass appropriations bills and budgets and stuff like that. And there are going to be things they want to do. They're going to want to show that they can govern. They want to I suspect they will be pretty united on the war in the Middle East against ISIS. I would not be surprised to see some conversation about whether there can be tax loopholes closed. It's going to be really hard to do because, of course, what Obama wants to do and what the Republicans want to do, they touch each other in various places, but they then diverge dramatically from there. So I'm not really sure that the little pieces they agree on are enough to drive a major piece of legislation. But you'll see some effort. I mean, I think they're going to try and actually pass something.
I want to touch on immigration and Homeland Security funding before we're done. Last week, the House passed a bill that would block funding for the immigration changes the president has made. Some Republicans defected from their own party. Passed the House. Is it going to pass the Senate?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I mean, of course, in the Senate, you got a 60-vote threshold. That's the first problem. And then the second problem is, you know, even some of the Republicans now are backing away from this notion of a showdown that might force some kind of partial closure of the Department of Homeland Security. Now, Ron Johnson, your senator, has said that maybe that's not such a bad idea, that closing down Homeland Security wouldn't really affect much because most of them are already governed by a bunch of security exemptions that would keep them on the job even in a shutdown, which is I'll give him credit. That's partly true, although then you end up having to pay those people back anyway, and it becomes a whole complicated mess. I don't think that is the strategy Republicans want to pursue. They want to avoid what the American public has clearly seen as an irresponsible way to govern, is these shutdowns. So they're looking for a way around that problem. I honestly don't know at this moment what their solution is, but they've got a couple of weeks to figure it out.
So we may not see the kind of brinksmanship that brings us close to or over the edge into partial or full shutdowns.
Right, and the interesting thing about that House appropriations bill that included a ban on Obama's immigration executive order is that they passed it early enough in January that they've got several weeks before they have to get to the deadline. So they've got time to work it out, basically. It was not a last-minute cliffhanger.
Paul, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great week.
You too. That's USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. We're talking about Congress's reaction to President Obama's State of the Union speech last night. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickert, is off today. We're on the verge of a demographic milestone in the United States, according to the Pew Research Center. At some point, maybe this year, the members of the millennial generation will outnumber the baby boomers. Both generations are in the 75 million neighborhood, and immigrants are nudging millennials toward the number one slot. A lot of the numbers, of course, depend on definitions. Millennials are those born from 1981 to 97, at least in this study. Baby boomers from 1946 to 1964. But no matter how you slice it, these are two big generations of Americans. So does this passing of the torch mean something important for our society, for workplaces, for how we get along with each other? Jeffrey Arnett joins us now. He's a research professor in the Department of Psychology at Clark University. His books include Emerging Adulthood, The Winding Road from the Late Teens Through the 20s, and Getting to 30, A Parent's Guide to the 20-something Years. Jeffrey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Well, I guess we knew this tipping point was going to come someday. What do you see as the significance of this this transition, more millennials now than or soon anyway than any other generation?
Well, I don't think we really know yet because they're still young. They're really just making their way into the workforce and into family life, and their life stories really have yet to be written. But I think you could at least say that their numbers will give them power in American society as a voting bloc. I mean, we know that they tend to be quite a bit more liberal than their parents or grandparents are, and so as they become older and the central part of the electorate, that could be reflected in voting patterns. We know too that they have more liberal views or more tolerance of diversity, shall we say, in sexual orientation, in religious beliefs. They are more likely to have friends who are from different ethnic groups. They're more likely to marry or have romantic relationships with other people across ethnic groups. So all those distinctive features that they have will be more and more part of American society as they move into adulthood.
Now, in your research, you focus a lot on this concept of emerging adulthood. And we're talking, I think, the 18 to 29 years, which is where the millennials, most of them, are now. Why is that time span so important? How much does it set the agenda for the rest of our lives?
Well, it's hugely important. It's the time when most people lay the foundation for their adult lives. And I gave it the name emerging adulthood as a new life stage because I really think that 18 to 29 is so much different now than it was 50 years ago when people were getting married and having their first child around age 20, 21, and when so many fewer people went to college or university than do now. So now the 20s has become this time of great flux and upheaval when people are trying out different paths but not yet settled until they get close to age 30. So I felt like that was a permanent change in the 18 to 29 age period, which is why I proposed it as a life stage instead of a generational change. I began studying them 20 years ago when there was a lot of talk about Generation X, and that book by that name had just come out, and there was a lot of talk about them as this sort of disaffected and aimless generation. But in my view, as I started my research at that time, I saw it as is already a permanent change, and it hasn't changed. It's just grown since the 20 years that I've been studying them.
Yeah, looking back at baby boomers, they weren't so much emerging into adulthood in that 18 to 29 zone. They were functioning as adults, I think, by most standards. Does that shape, color the way the baby boomer generation looks at Generation X and millennials?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, there is this generational antagonism that I've seen many times in the 20 years that I've been studying emerging adults, that boomers, the parents and other adults who are in that middle-aged generation right now, tend to scoff at the young and complain about how lazy and selfish they are. And part of that is just the way it's always been, the young, the old complaining about the young. But I do think it's partly that things have changed fast in the last 30, 40 years, and a lot of baby boomers see today's emerging adults, and they're not getting married at 20 or 21, and not until maybe 29 or 30, and they stay in education longer, and they have a more unstable work pattern in their 20s, and they, rather egocentrically, I think, compare that to themselves when they were in their 20s. And because emerging adults are making these transitions to a stable adult life later than they did, they think there's something defective about today's young people. But there's really not. It makes sense to wait now until you're close to 30 to make those transitions, because you need to devote your 20s to getting an education and getting a stable place in the labor market. And there's no hurry to have to get married and have children either if you're only going to have one or two of them, as most of today's emerging adults want to do.
How much of that difference, that putting off those markers of adulthood, how much of that is the way that these new generations are being brought up and making a choice about this versus the economy, the changing nature of work and family, frankly, that they're going into? Where do we put the weight on this this different type of adulthood?
Well, that's another excellent question. We have made this shift over the last 50 years from a manufacturing economy to more of an information and services economy, and that does require more education or training after high school. People who don't get anything beyond high school are really behind the eight ball in the new economy. They have an unemployment rate that's twice as high as those who are college educated, and they make $1 million less over the course of their working lives compared to people who have graduated from college. So it is partly an economic shift. There is more and more of a reward than ever before for getting education, and so a lot of people are pursuing that. But it is also because expectations for work have changed. Today's young people, when they go into the job market, they're not just looking for a job. Even if it pays well, for most of them, that won't be enough. They want to find something that is personally rewarding and that they feel makes the best of their talents and interests. They pursue what I call identity-based work, meaning that they want to find something that really expresses the heart of who they see themselves to be. And that's very frustrating sometimes to boomers, who say, gee, kid, why don't you just get a job? Or parents will see their kid quit or turn down a job that pays well and has a health care plan and a good 401k, and the emerging adult will say, you know, I don't want to do it. It doesn't seem interesting to me. And parents will slap their heads and say, it's not supposed to be fun. That's why they call it work. That's forgetting that when they were young, they sort of invented the idea in that baby boom generation that work should be fun, but they feel like they've grown wiser.
So to the extent that a generation like the millennials might be getting a bad rap from earlier generations, how can they push back in a nice way or an angry way? How can they push back and say, no, it's a different time, we're different people, but it's a valid life path we're choosing?
Well, I think they feel kind of cowed by all the criticism they get, and they are young and they are inexperienced, and the people criticizing them are much older and more powerful than they are. But I do think there is a sentiment among them, I can't really say how widespread it is, that they're getting a bad rap from their parents and grandparents, and that it's not fair. I saw a great video on the internet the other day that was called, I believe it was called, Millennials, We Suck and We're Sorry. And it was this brilliant satire, all people in their 20s, saying, you know, sort of apologizing for being lazy and selfish and useless as their elders see them. And then it gradually pointed out how none of those things are true in this subtle, funny, brilliant way, and that actually the boomers are the ones who ought to be ashamed for handing them this world where they have trillions of dollars of debt to pay off in the government that their parents and grandparents accumulated, and a ruined environment. So that sort of thing, that sort of fits the humor of the generation. It's sort of the John Stewart generation as far as humor goes. And it's a way of making the point rather gently, but nevertheless very sharply and effectively, that they really are getting kind of sick of being scolded by people who have a lot to apologize for themselves.
We're talking to Jeffrey Arnett. He's a psychologist at Clark University. Looking at the rise of the millennial generation, we are on the verge of seeing millennials become the largest age cohort by numbers in the United States, and what that means for society, for work, and more. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like there are some overarching differences between generations, like the millennials, the baby boomers, us Generation Xers in between? Do you feel like there's a generation gap in your family or at your workplace? If you're a millennial, what does the world of work look like from your perspective? Do you think you're getting a bad rap from the previous generations? Join us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now about a generational passing of the torch. The millennials are on the verge of outnumbering baby boomers as the biggest generation in the United States. Psychology professor Jeffrey Arnett stays with us. We're talking about some of the implications of this transition, what might change in our workplace, in society, and how different generations view each other, how they get along. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're a baby boomer, what do you think of the young adults these days? Or if you're a millennial, do you think you're getting a bad rap from the rest of society? How do you get along with people from different generations at your workplace? Or are we just overgeneralizing about each of these generations in the first place? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we get to our callers, Jeffrey, I just wanted to touch on that last point I made. How confident can we be when we're making generalizations about a generational cohort when there's a lot of differences in terms of, you know, income, race, region, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I generally try to avoid generational generalizations because of exactly that reason. But there is a certain truth that there are distinctive characteristics of each cohort of Americans. So I think as long as we keep that caveat in mind that they are diverse in each generation, I think we can have an illuminating discussion about what some of the differences might be. And as a way of talking about how social change is occurring over the long term. But these changes are really mostly gradual. They're not usually in generational chunks that are really distinct.
Let's get to our callers. We've got Becca on the line in Elk Mound. Becca, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I so appreciate this show and especially this topic.
So what do you think about this?
Well, I am the daughter of two baby boomers. I'm 25 right now. My parents both waited until their 30s to have kids because they wanted to establish themselves in their own careers and that kind of thing. I just wanted to enter the conversation and just share a funny story about my family. Going through college, I worked three jobs. I graduated without any debt because of that. But I took longer than the specified 4 years for graduation. So because of that, I was told by my family multiple times that I wasn't working hard enough and that I wasn't going at a fast enough speed. Now, if you think about that, I graduated without any debt. My other siblings all have massive amounts of debt. However, they took less time graduating. So I just thought that conversation with my own personal family was really interesting coming from my parents' point of view.
You can't win. Thanks a lot for the call, Becca. So in some cases, no matter how you play it, the older generation is going to look at you as lazy, Jeffrey.
Yeah, I think that's revealing, isn't it? Statistically, today's students are much more likely than in their parents' generation to work while they're going to college. And it's because of the astronomical rise in the cost of college education. And it must be very irritating. She seemed to be taking it very well, but it must be very irritating to be working even harder than your parents did at your age and be told you're not doing enough, that you're somehow lazy because you're taking longer than they did to finish their four-year degree that cost less than half of what her degree does.
Becca, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Leslie in Lake Geneva. Leslie, hi.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I get along. I'm 60 years old, and I've worked since I was 18, and I get along great with the kids at work. But I just wondered, with saying that millennials feel like they're looked upon as lazy or whatever, and that they want to pick and choose a job that they can relate to and be creative, I just wondered how many of those kids are living at home having the bills paid for them. That's the only time that I disagree with the, I'm not going to get a job until I'm fulfilled by it or whatever. You know what I'm saying? And as for Becca's parents, that's terrible.
Leslie, thanks a lot for the call. So, Jeffrey, I don't know. I know you do a lot of surveys of people, especially in the emerging adult range. Do you have a sense of how many are still living with parents?
Yeah, I do. It's about 40% who move home at some point after moving out. And the caller's complaint is a very common one. That somehow reflects selfishness or laziness or that they're spoiled or something. But I just haven't seen any evidence of that. They almost always move home for economic reasons. In other words, they can't afford to live on their own because they're not making enough money or because they live in an urban area where the cost of living is very high. So it's true, as I said earlier, they have very high expectations for work, and they don't want to take just any job and get on a career path that they're going to hate for the next 30 years. But I don't know why we should despise them for that. I mean, part of the value of this new life stage of emerging adulthood, where you stay relatively independent during your 20s and don't take on the commitments of marriage and parenthood yet, is that you can have more time to look to find something that's more along the lines of something that you want to do. I don't think we should scoff at that or ridicule that. I think we should celebrate it. I think they have a lot better chance of finding something they're really going to enjoy that way.
Leslie, thanks a lot for that call. Still time for you at 800-642-1234 or join in on the Central Time Facebook page. Jeffrey, to quote an old song title, why can't we be friends? Is there room for baby boomers, millennials, and the rest of us to get along with each other?
I'm glad you brought that up because actually they do get along surprisingly well. You know, I did a national survey of parents for my book, Getting to 30. I did a national survey of parents of 18 to 29-year-olds, and I was shocked at how positive they were about their kids, including their kids who have moved home. When I asked them, the ones who had an 18 to 29-year-old currently living home, if that was a situation that was mostly positive for them, mostly negative, or a mix of positive and negative. And I thought most people would say a mix of positive and negative. I mean, that's true about almost everybody you live with, I would think. But instead, the results were 61% said it was mostly positive. 6% said it was mostly negative. So 10 times as many were enjoying having their emerging adults at home as those who were wishing they would move out. It's funny that we have this cultural cliche that parents just can't wait to get rid of their emerging adult kids. It's utterly false.
No kidding. That actually surprises me to hear those numbers. You think this is a recipe for conflict. It's not something we really do in America. There's a stigma of being the younger person living there. What kind of things do people say about it? Why do we know why they're liking this?
A couple of things are going. One is that the kids have become a lot more easy to get along with. I mean, I've noticed this in my interviews with emerging adults that they really come to understand their parents better and like them. And to parents, that's such a great payoff after adolescence, which is often a time of high conflict between parents and kids, that their kids then grow into their 20s and are such nice people and like to be around them. And both parents and emerging adults talk about it as being more like a friendship and that they really enjoy that friendship. And the other thing, I think, is that parents realize wisely that this is sort of the last hurrah, that their kids are going to leave, and as soon as they can afford to do so, much as they love their parents, they still would prefer to live on their own. And that once they leave that second time, it's probably going to be the last time. And parents value that relationship and value that closeness, and they know they're going to miss it when it's gone.
So, briefly, as we wrap up, Jeffrey, are millennials the wave of the future? Are future generations, do you think, going to see similar trends?
Well, I think so. I think, as I said at the outset of the program, I don't think their story is yet written. I think we can see certain trends, as I mentioned. They tend to be more on the liberal side politically and in terms of social issues like gay marriage. But who knows what will happen? They're still young. They're still emerging into adulthood. And it'll be great to see how their story turns out.
To be continued. Jeffrey, thanks so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
That's Jeffrey Arnett from Clark University. His books include Emerging Adulthood, The Winding Road from the Late Teens Through the 20s. A couple of days back, we talked about the death of the American watering hole, the places where people could gather with other people from their community, things like diners, taverns, a third place, our guest called it, outside of work and home. Our guest says we're so focused on our technology, we're not making the time to go out, interact with random real people in our communities. Well, some real people use their technology, specifically Facebook, to weigh in on that. Carla in Little Chute, Wisconsin says, Seth's Coffee there is always busy from young to old. They've got great food and coffee. Well, I hope they have good conversation, too. Thomas wrote in and said, how have you not mentioned church? It's the natural third place for tens of millions or more Americans. Elisa, pretty much at the same second, wrote another piece of this. People have stopped going to church. Church provides that third space of community and people you talk to. You can even watch church online now instead of attending a service in person. And Emily wrote, I now work from home, so I've lost the second and third space, and now I'm home with my baby. Where can I go to have social interaction? Well, it's through events with kids or by volunteering. You can keep the conversation going over at the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know if you have that third place, something like Cheers, if you remember that from back in the 80s.